good stuff.
There we go.
All right. Great. I hope you're all feeling fueled and warmed. Here. It's like it's just me. I bought a shot for you if you want it. Yeah. The thing I forgot to mention before was about the money. Yes, if you want to give some money for the cost of the cake, then you can. Please do. That would be great. There's a thing, a jar with some money. You can do it or you cannot. Whatever. That'd be great. Any other things? No? Cool. Thank you very much, Joe. Thank you very much, Justin. Have a shot. And off we go. Cheerio.
Cheerio.
Actually, the only other thing might be is we normally never finish the keg, so please drink it.
Yes, please stay.
Really?
Otherwise we need to do something.
Normally
else
we have like house dinners for the next 3 nights where we're just like pouring out of the keg, drinking beer. Which is great. But it is, you know, for here and now, so
stay don't feel shy.
Yeah, definitely. Pass your drinks, your cups back and we'll fill them and do it and it'll be good. Have you got one?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, can I do internal smoking here? Because I saw an ashtray. Fantastic. Like, that's the first thing since, you know, like, thank you. Like, it's always great to be at the garage. Like, is it the best, the most intellectual fucking institution in, like, Australia at the current time? I think that's right. I unfortunately, I agreed with everything that Joe said, which is also, like, another problem about going on after Joe. And what were the other things about that? Except now I'm probably going to talk a bit more about slavery, which I really didn't want to do. And as Joe said, it's slavery, high five. It's fucking back, isn't it, Joe? Slavery's back. Like, but did it ever really go away? Like, I don't know. I think that, like, look, there are a number of issues, and Joe obviously was getting worked up about this too, about crud. a latest prime minister, like, and one of the things I guess that I hear is around the problem of refugees to this country, and I wanted to start this talk under a banner of something that I think Jo was implying, but I don't think she actually used the word quite directly, which is an integral part of the human condition is how fucking cruel people are. Like, whether or not they do them for good reasons or bad reasons, whether indeed they have reasons or whether they indeed just have kind of affects or feelings about it, what people love more than anything else is to fucking be cruel to other people. Like, absolutely cruel. So no matter what's your position on the refugee debate, no matter whether or you think this is a good thing or a bad thing that we have all of these, like, offshore processing things, and we could talk in some detail about the ways that they're like managed and retailed through the media. But whether or not, even if you agree 100% with Crud and Abbott, and that these moves are only actually to be kind to people, which is the biggest justification that we hear, is that we actually help refugees. We're stopping them from getting on leaky boats and coming here and paying people, smugglers, who, of course, you know, dangerous criminals making an economic buck for themselves under anyway, like, they're neoliberal kind of investors too. But whatever you hear two things. You hear, one, this is a good thing, because one of the things that human beings like to do in this kind of imaginary way that Joe mapped out is it's very important that normalisation is also about doing the good, and we're all good people and we all like doing good things, and an integral part of our image of ourselves is how good we are. I cannot believe that Tony Abbott does not think of himself as a morally good person, and it's quite clear in Kevin Crud's case that he's a morally good person too. And in fact, that's something that we have to say that they share with every single one of us, which is what good people we are. We're really fucking good people. And every now and again we might do something that we think is a bit bad, or we might feel a bit guilty about something, or we might think we might have acted better in some situation or another. But essentially, we're good. And that's very, very important. We should never forget what we share with other people, which is how good we are, right? One of the problems with this is that in order to be good, we have to be unbelievably, unspeakably cruel as well. But even the cruelty, there's no cruelty that we can perpetuate that condemns our good. In fact, the more cruel we are, actually, the better it turns out that we turn out to be. And so even though people have talked about this as a race to the bottom and blah, 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 in all sorts of ways with regards to the latest Australian sort of political argy-bargy over the refugees, the most two most important things to remember is these are good people we're dealing with. Everyone's good, apart from the people smugglers, of course, but everyone else is good. And at the same time that everyone else is good, that the spectacle of cruelty is absolutely crucial to perpetrate in order to show just how good we are. And it's I guess the orientation I'd like to begin this talk with is we're all good people and we're all showing scenes of unspeakable cruelty in our everyday lives, and it's very important that we do so because it doesn't compromise our goodness. On the contrary, the more cruel we are, the better it shows in the end somehow by a kind of dialectical magic. It turns out that we're going to be. Now, I presume this is why, and I'm currently full of hate for, I'm in some horrible, like, tweet flame walker, tweet war with a whole load of motherfuckers who I don't fucking know, because I made the fucking mistake of responding to one of Jeff Sparrow's stupid tweets about, now look what they're doing to, you know, teenagers on the dole, which is basically to set up work camps for them, in which teenagers on the dole, who, of course, like refugees and like Indigenous people, they're, you know, people in a, you know, completely, well, I don't know, the weakest members of our community. And one of the things you have to do as a good person is take the weakest members of your community and fuck them over totally, right? You actually have to. And you have to do it, when I say cruelty, this is a bit of a general word, I'll speak more specifically about it soon, but basically what's the best form of contemporary cruelty you can do to people? It's to put them in a camp. What did the Nazis do that was fantastic for everyone? They perfected the concentration camp. Now, even though people after the Second World War, some of them seem to think that was a bad thing, it's a technique that was invented that actually no one really thought, hey, let's not have that happen again. It's like, what a brilliant fucking idea. We can now make people better in large numbers of different people from all over the world with basically nothing in common, and we can squelch them together in a camp and operate on them as a human multiplicity continuously. And not only will we do this, we will make it unbearable. Unbearable for them in absolutely every single way. And when we do, but whenever anyone says anything, we have to say, but this is for their good. And this is not only for their good, because they will be better off as a result of being in a camp and being tortured indefinitely and under all sorts of, like, incredibly hideous circumstances, which I'm happy to talk about, but probably more happy not to talk about some of the actual techniques that that are deployed in these camps. But it helps all of us. Not only will these people be better, we'll be better. Our society will be improved as a result of torturing a whole load of other people who we put in camps for their own good. So now this technique's, of course, being extended to, other weakest members of our society, these times internally rather than the internally excluded in Australia, who, of course, by definition, the Indigenous people, because the whole state of Australia, and we have to remember this, is a historically anomalous state. The only people who meet the criteria for national belonging in Australia are on the model of every other European state, and basically, we can talk about this, but basically since ancient Greece, and the two criteria that normally are required for belonging in any state, ancient or modern, the polis, the imperium, or the modern nation state, two criteria. Your parents are from the place and you're born on the soil, right? Now, the only people who meet that criteria in Australia are the Indigenous people. They're the only people, but by definition under terra nullius, they're the only people excluded from the goods of the state. And so Australia from the beginning, we have to remember this, was being set up in which the only criteria for belonging are neither blood nor soil. So the people who should actually, the only people who meet the criteria for belonging to a state, Indigenous Australians, are excluded by dictate of terra nullius in a totally paradoxical way. So Australia, modern Australia since 1788, has basically been from the beginning a state without any citizens. And moreover, not only was it a state without any citizens on the declaration, or at least the presumption of terra nullius, but it starts, what adds as a European settlement, it starts as a penal colony in which, by definition, there aren't any citizens. They've all been the criminal scum, mainly Irish, as it happens, Irish Catholics, who are still criminal scum of this country. And like, I wish someone would actually come out and say this, like, as strongly as I just have.
Somebody else.
Well, you know, you've got to do things for yourself sometimes. If no one else is stepping up, you've got to really name names, haven't you? Like, so I'm naming names. Like, and, of course, in a penal colony, you've basically... Well, what have you got? You've got, like... You've got maybe three sorts of people. You've got the prisoners, you've got the guards, and you've got the managers. And so I would like to say this is how Australia begins, and literally the state that we're in now is a very deep historical one, a state with no citizens in which the only people who should who meet the criteria for belonging to a state are excluded by the foundational act of the state itself, like neither blood nor soil, terra nullius, indigenous people, out, and then the only people who actually are here are either, they're all foreign nationals who are either prisoners, guards, or middle managers. And that may explain some of the weirdness of your workplaces today, because Australia has never, it seems to me, like discarded this foundational, these kind of foundational operation. And the reason I'm in this fucking Twitter war is because I was like, blah, blah, extension of biopolitical techniques from indigenes who are kind of the excluded included, and then the refugees who are the included excluded, if that makes sense. They're both included by... They're included and submitted absolutely to the full force of the extremity of Australian law by being literally excluded and cut out and placed in enclaves in now... foreign territories, or indigenes who are included but excluded in their very inclusion. And of course, what can you do with both of these sets of people? Intervention is an intervention which is an assault on their very existence as a people, their legitimacy as a people. And this goes back to some of the things that Joe was discussing, which still have. She said, has slavery ever ended? No. How could it possibly end in Trinidad under these conditions where if you were a slave, then any identity you can possibly claim is a priori compromised by its own history. So you either claim no identity, in which case you're fucked, or you claim an identity, in which case it's a fucked identity, and therefore you're fucked. And so you're fucked that way, and then you're fucked this way. And that's the... Now, that's cruelty. That's a kind of a definition of cruelty to me, and of institutional cruelty in some ways. And this is now I can come to the stupid content of my fucking tweet war, which was, has anyone read Robert Hughes's Fatal Short? Like, obviously, he was like a swollen bourgeois Australian art critic of like the most fruity proportions who, you know, basically... Would you get drunk and kill people while drunk driving in the Northern Territories after fishing trips and so on and get off. But, you know, that aside, at the beginning of the Fatal Shore, he says this incredible thing. Australia was the bastard love child of basically Jeremy Bentham and the Marquis de Sade, which I think is absolutely right. You have utilitarian social democracy under conditions of rational calculation of the greatest good for the greatest number. And what do you do with the Marquis de Sade? And this is where I got into trouble, because everyone now identifies Marquis de Sade with a thoughtless, fat twit who liked whipping women, which has got nothing to do with the Marquis de Sade at all. But the Marquis de Sade is, people love the spectacle of other people being fucking tortured in front of them by the state, and that is one of the things that if we underestimate in the current fucking thing around refugees, not only the enjoyment at the spectacle of cruelty that is being relayed to us, the absolute love and enjoyment of it that must be being experienced, not just by other members of our society, but by ourselves insofar as we think that we're good in negating that situation. And so one of the problems that I would want to talk about here is, with respect to human cruelty, we're all implicated, and we're all implicated to the extent that we continue to think of ourselves as good. Does that make sense? All right. So, I didn't end up writing this talk because when I did start thinking about this, I realised what I could do, and I will do this under other circumstances, is I could literally cut and paste a completely coherent document that was completely plagiarised, that would run from the beginning to the end in the words of absolutely Tony Abbott, Kevin Rudd, the Marquis de Sade, Jeremy Bentham, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, what, Tony Birch, Nick Heron, Joe, and it would be one coherent document which reads as if it was written by a single person from the beginning to end. And precisely because of this, if we're talking, I'm going to invoke a concept of Jacques Rancière's here, which is the division, division and distribution of the sensible, which every polity engages in, where you divide up the goods of the community by sharing them out, but in that very partitioning, you also end up with a particular kind of implicit hierarchy that's so absolute and deep that no one can actually see it. Classic anthropological thing. If you ask a fish what's the most important thing in its life, the last thing it will say is water. Can you remember? I can't remember who said that. Ruth Barkin, maybe? I don't know. Anyway, that's part of where we are, is we're so deep in a fucking corruption of corruption and cruelty that there's no longer any edge to or any place from which we're able to sort of like crack apart or intervene in this situation without precisely repeating all of the worst aspects and all the worse so, insofar as we continue to think we're good people intervening in a good, healthy, decent way, human way. This, of course, then I couldn't do this, so now I'm just like, I'll be flailing for the next 40 minutes or something on these on these questions. But it sent me back to Carl Schmitt, the great, if you can use the word great for a fucking, like Nazi valet, basically. He wrote the legal justification for the for Hitler's takeover, but also one of the great political philosophers of the 20th century. And in a number of books, he comes up with some quite radical theories of human political life. But one of the crucial things that he says in one of his early books is that in the end, political theories come down to kind of an ethical basis, and it's either: do we presume that human beings are good, in which case we generate certain kinds of images of polities which are more or less, I guess, ironic? Can I say ironic? I'll say ironic. Or we say the opposite, which is men are evil. And, of course, we understand women are men. Women are men, right? Yeah, women are men. Because we're not going to talk about... Actually, I will talk about women here. This is a really fantastic moment in a Nicole Leroux book about ancient Athens, where she's talking precisely about the problems ancient Athenians have with blood and soil. Because, of course, as I said before, what does it mean to be an Athenian and an Athenian citizen? It means both your parents have to have been Athenians, and you have to be born, basically in Athens. The problem is, women can't be citizens, right? They don't even exist. So the Athenian state is constantly confronted with this problem, which is both your parents have to be, but you've only got one parent and it's your dad. And then, of course, that opens up the problem of all these other people who are like, hey, what about me, mate? And they're like, but your mum's not. And they're like, you don't have a mum either, do you? So... Leaving aside the fact that women may not always be men, to the extent that the women count at all, it's important that they're men. Men are evil is the Carl Schmittian thesis, basically. And anyone who does not think that human beings are essentially evil, and I will use evil to, even though it's been rubbed off, to characterise some of the operations that Joe was speaking about in their very reflexivity. Yes, there's an idealisation, but that idealisation, and this is where I'm going to start talking about Freud dude, as they called him. Does anyone remember this film, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure? And it's like, Sigmund Freud, It's just Billy the Kid and even Billy the Kid. I know, that's so old, isn't it? Billy the Kid and Socrates are like, just who is this guy? He's such a dick. Tell me about your mother. Yeah, tell me about your mother. Well, I guess a lot of political discourse, and since I started talking about women not being men, I'm sorry, it was a ridiculous proposition, but since I've talked about it and since the mother kinship, I suppose, would you call it kinship? Mothers? They kinship? I guess that counts as kinship. Since mothers count and don't count simultaneously, so much of political life really is an address to the mother on the... This is just an aside, by the way. I don't want anyone to talk about it, and I'm not sure why I'm mentioning it. But I'm
Don't tweet it.
No, don't tweet. Stop tweeting. Hold the tweets. It was like, where's your mother? And I'd really like to ask that. Who's your mother? Can you ask that? Yeah. And it, like, this is the Levantine famous sort of says, your mother, you're the son of a bastard camel and us, you know, and your mother was a, like... What sort of mother is being addressed in all of this political discourse? And what sort of, like, quiet, giving body underwrites the phantasms of politics? But in any case, like, let's come back to the fact that men are evil, and men are evil being the basis for any, like, at least in Carl Schmitt's view, any rational, sensible, workable... no matter what adjective you want to use or qualification, what sort of community you would have has to require that you think of human beings as inherently and essentially evil, and so your policy can only work on the basis that people are going to, at every stage, transgress, deliberately fuck it up, deliberately try and take control and take power. In his book on the politics of friendship, Derrida points to this moment in Carl Schmitt's theory, and says something that Carl Schmitt wouldn't want to say as a Nazi, and not really anti-Semitic, but, you know, if you're a Nazi, you can't really be into the Jews anymore. Is that right? And so Carl Schmitt becomes an anti-Semite as a rational necessity of supporting Hitler. There's many different kinds of, like, hatred, hostility towards the other. This is a classic, I guess, 20th century one, where you hate other groups not because you hate them in absolutely any way at all. In fact, some of my best friends happen to be Jews. Can I say that? Oh, some of my, yeah. Anyway, we don't ask me any more about that. I might talk about my brother. Kimship, like. One of the things is that you then end up with principled responses to particular groups of people on the basis of something that can now only be an incontrovertible rationalism. And the problem is for Derrida, as he points out vis-a-vis Schmitt at this point, okay, you want to say that men are evil and all men are evil, and that's the only basis on which the great political theorists of history have erected anything as a recognisably able to work political institution. So why don't you mention Freud? Because one of the things that Sigmund Freud is about, and he's about a lot of things, obviously. Tell me about the Freud dude. Tell me about your mother. But one of the things that Freud basically is very clear about is human beings are absolutely and incomprehensibly, abyssally evil, and there is no end to that evil. There is no possible end to that evil. And I want to give three moments from Freud before moving on to At the Moment I Know Not Where. The first moment comes in Civilization, Its Discontents, which is written in the late 1920s. Freud, and an Austrian Jew, who all of whose sisters, incidentally, will be obliterated in the Holocaust. Though, of course, he dies in 1939, and he himself has no... He doesn't know it, but he sees what's coming. And he says, civilization is discontent. He says, look, men are not, creatures endowed with a modicum of aggression who can defend themselves or will be able to rouse themselves to defend themselves if necessary, but otherwise just want to be left alone and have a nice, comfortable life. He says, no, on the contrary, what they would want to do more than anything else is kill, mutilate and torture their neighbour, and any other person who presents themselves to a human being emerges not only as a threat about whom one should be feared, but someone whom you can exercise your most beautiful inner desires upon. And what is a beautiful inner desire for Freud? It's just a way of thinking about what you would do to your neighbour if and only you could. Like, and there is no limit, as he says. So that's the first moment I would want to talk about in Freud, where human beings are not just... human people with a modicum of aggression, they are aggression. And they're not just aggression in the sense of, like, hatred or anger, although I'll come to this in a minute, Yes, they are. No, the other person is not just a threat, someone to be feared, but someone to be terrorised. What you want most from another person is the opportunity to terrorise them up all the way up to the point of economic exploitation, rape, torture, and then death. And that would be the best possible outcome for you with all of your friends, like, frankly. So that's the first Freudian moment. The second moment is, however, is that no one can do this because you can't have a functioning policy if you'd like torture and mutilate absolutely everyone else. And, you know, a torturer always needs henchmen. To get people tortured, it's a lot of trouble. If you think about the amount of effort that the Americans currently go to do rendition, drones, fuck me, Guantanamo Bay, the amount of money, the headaches, the legal bullshit. Torturing people needs henchmen, and you need a lot of fucking support to do it. So you can't just do it, right? You can have a society of torturers. America's showing us the way, and I think, you know, as a kind of guiding light. Well, they're doing a pretty good job, you'd have to admit. Like, if anyone can do it, Americans can, right? Like, part of the problem is how do you get people to continue to want, like, who never, none of us ever give up on this, beautiful dream of torturing and mutilating our nearest and dearest for Freud. So how do you get people to do anything at all? And Freud then comes up in about the same time, a little early, he writes an essay called The Economic Problem of Masochism. And the economic problem of masochism is quite an anodyne title, but the problem is that, well, one of the best ways of torturing other people is to do it to yourself first and foremost. You've got the opportunity, you can get away with it. In fact, other people will encourage you to get away with it because it gives them a nice vision of someone else, like in pain and suffering. This is why, for a long time, I realised some of my friends, this happened in the 90s, where, like, I had a couple of bad years and there were some people who were only around when I was really, really suffering. And they were really lovely people and very, very supportive, and they got me through some bad times. But then I realised they weren't fair weather friends, they were foul weather friends. They only wanted to be there to enjoy the sight of me in absolute fucking agony. And so, like, if I have a moral sort of, not a moral, but just a kind of a practical suggestion from this talk, is that anyone who helps you when you're down, you should be very, very wary of that person. Yes, you should. Don't smile at me like that. It's not very comforting. And so masochism, the economic problem of masochism, is one of the crucial ways in that human beings train themselves through torturing themselves and showing themselves spectacularly, or presenting themselves often in conditions of, you know, quiet intimacy or of care and concern, to others in a way that enables the social bond to be made, not just through identification of the positive or hero, but to see someone suffering, what a primal pleasure that is, the pure form of human enjoyment. And the thing for Freud is you can even get off, and this is the economic problem, enjoying the spectacle of torturing yourself. Because if there's no one else, anyone will do, and since the thing that comes to hands, if I can put it like that, like most readily, like I'm not sure which part of my body to grasp at this point, like you will first and foremost guess the pleasure of autoeroticism, and the pleasure of autoeroticism is, like, they used to, I mean, think of all the, like, the old school, euphemisms for masturbation. They're all about damaging or harming yourself. Now, people always, these days, we think what unenlightened age they lived in, and now we know masturbation's healthy and so on. What a disaster, right? Let's take those descriptions very, very seriously. You were damaging yourself, but of course you enjoyed damaging yourself, and everyone knows of that. Now it's meant to be a healthy, happy, like, productive identification. I learned to touch myself, right? Like, it's like, wow, what we like about that, the erotics of that are not the pleasure in oneself, but the pleasure one takes, the horror one has and the pleasure one takes at actually harming yourself in a very enjoyable way, right? So this is part of the problem and why no one likes Freud, because no one likes to think that the pleasures that they have are always at someone else's expense. Yeah.
Like exercise as well, like thrashing yourself out at 6 a.m.
Perfect, that's right, thrashing, like boot camp. Well, boot camp, where this word camp since the Second World War, let's just be frank, the fact that you can call boot camp or thesis writing camp, which is now like, and these are now considered like good things, fuck. Fucking fucked. Like, although I was pointing out to some people, I was talking to someone, an old guy from the Sustainability Institute at Melbourne University the other day, and he was like, we've got 25 years at most. It's fucked. The world's fucked. I'm like, great. So we've only got 25 years left to totally lacerate us, thrash ourselves in this life to death. And what greater spectacle, this is also important to Freud, is the, yeah.
Do you think some of the problem with some of the debates around the asylum seeker stuff is having these hyperbolic arguments? Do you think there's a need
Absolutely.
To induce the hyperbole?
It's not a need to induce, there's an absolute drive and pleasure in making sure that the hyperbole, it has to happen. I don't know if you feel the same way as I do, but it's very hard for me not to escalate the rhetoric whenever. But that's literally working your way up, working yourself up. Now, what's work? No one ever liked work in human history, right? Work itself is a fucking index of exploitation in which you're, as Marx puts it, you're being, you know, alienating yourself, you're producing a great bodily pain, and it's a kind of Hegelian dialectic of master and slave. So the slave works. The slave is the worker in which everything will be extracted from that body, and now we have wage slavery in which they, you know, they even pay you a little bit for it, but it's always less than you've given. But that working oneself up is really, really crucial, that none of us are able to speak in any way that actually says, can I not just point out that, yes, maybe you're right, maybe this is the right way to go with refugees, but it is still cruel. It is. I don't see that there's any way of contravening that. But if I say that to anyone whatsoever, I'm immediately met, like in a political, by just a kind of torrent of gibberish, right? Like, no. I understand. Yes, that you may think that's the right way. Maybe it is the right. But it is cruel. You're actually really seriously damaging these people. You know that. In fact, it's an integral part of the very justice. No, that hyperbole, the absolute inability to stop, is part of this abyssal problem, I guess, which is the problem of cruelty and the problem of masochism, because no matter how good we want to be about it, in fact, in being good about it, we work ourselves into a kind of frenzy, which is a frenzy of self-pleasure. And that's part of the problem. And maybe we can talk at the end about the necessity for self-stimulation that's involved in that, and the sorts of kind of minute operations of psychic self-stimulation, which contravene something else which you often see, you can see all around the world in very many different anthropological and cultural contexts, which is there's always someone pops up to say, no, it's unfeeling that's really important here, not feeling. Ataraxia, adiaphora, zen nothingness, Tao not knowing. There's always, in every culture, someone tries to say, let's just see if we can not start to not feel something, because the operations that you have to perform on yourself, long meditative, long weird experiments with your body, in order to stop feeling so strenuously, maybe that's the only point at which, instead of this self-stimulating, you can actually have a position that doesn't immediately like generate this abyss. Or, you know, the famous internet theory of the internet, the law of the internet, which any exchange that goes on long enough will end up in Hitler and the Nazis, right? Yeah, that's the internet version, right? I can't remember whose law it was. It's some
Godwin's law.
Whose law?
Godwin.
Godwin's law. And what a great name, Godwin. Who better to tell us about Nazis on the internet? So that operation is. So when you feel yourself getting upset and worked up, yes, there's a good reason for it, but it's not the reason that you think of. It's very important to work yourself up about it, and if you don't work yourself up about it, you can't continue to maintain your goodness and the situation as it stands, because as soon as you start to polarise in that way, that self-stimulation or self-dosing where you just go rocket up like in a kind of schwärmeristic moment, that actually cuts off any possibility of any real change happening for anyone else.
So
the other person.
Hyperbole is the solution to apathy.
No, apathy is the solution to hyperbole. That's what I'm saying. Apathy is actually something very... Yes, not enough people are completely apathetic. Like, and this is one of my suggestions. Instead of the Occupy movement, we need an unoccupy movement. Everyone just leaves. Like, I don't care. I just don't fucking care at all. Well, what happens when it all goes fucking dead?
I wish someone would tweet that.
Unoccupy the garage.
Get out. Stay.
So that's the second moment from Freud. The first one was about like cruelty. The second point was about the economic problem of masochism and these routines of self escalation of hyperbolization. I don't know. Any of those, like that one engages in, which are literally masochistic practices, because the very means that you use to actualise your, I think, probably quite righteous hatred of this situation, they actually contravene through that hyperbole any fixing or any good intervention into the situation that you would like to make. And yet it's very difficult to stop yourself from engaging in it, and that's precisely the economic problem of masochism for Freud. And the third one is for Freud, and this is linked to the other two, is that, as he says, that the oldest relationship to objects that we have as like infants, it's hate rather than love. One loves oneself through variations, and one has to love oneself, otherwise one can't continue to function simply as an organism. But when there's a split, like the mirror stage between the self and the other, in which the very self starts to get modelled in particular ways, then the other can only be something that, yes, it's an index of narcissism, but not of self. You know, self-satisfying, you know, continual love, but of an alienated relationship. And so our first relationship to others is always that of hate. And so the sorts of things we have to do to ourselves to both continue to help that along and continue to pretend to ourselves and to others that we're not helping that along are part of the, I guess that's culture. So, mate, culture. See, this is where I got stuck, because I didn't know where I was going with this at this point, except
men are evil.
Men are evil. All of our relationships are deeply evil. The problem of generating, turning oneself... How does one become more apathetic, I guess, is the... And how does one become more apathetic in a situation in which... And this is where I would like to come back to some of the things that Joe's been speaking about again and take them up, because the fundamental human problem of slavery seems to me to be the very emblem of this. Like, slavery is the limit case in human... in human life of precisely the situation. There's some websites you can get on to find out how many slaves made any particular product that we're now wearing or we're now consuming. So it took 72 slaves in 13 different countries to make this jacket, for instance. And not just indentured labourers, because, of course, human beings love to, as Joe said, what in Trinidad replaces slavery? Indentured labour. Well, what's indentured labour? It's basically slavery with a fucking name change, right? Like, and moreover, the very different places from which one... Well, the other thing that's linked to is what are the things that help globalise slavery and support imperialism? Tea, cotton, tobacco, drugs, spices of all kinds. So we're all dosing ourselves continuously on stimulants that are precisely... Every cigarette you have isn't doing you damage. It's doing many other people much more damage than it's doing you. So if we think of slavery as the very emblem of human, in fact, I think it's probably the truth of human civilization par excellence. This is precisely the point of Freud talking about civilization, its discontents. He's not saying that whenever you have civilization, you have discontents. The German title is Das Unbehagen der Kultur, which is the malaise in... It's not civilization and it has discontents. Civilization is discontent. Where does the discontent come from? Because every civilization is a slave society. Every single fucking one of them, no matter how in social democratic Australia we've never had slavery, but actually it's impossible without some of the things I've already talked about, but also already in a globalised network, because Australia makes no sense without like a particular like 18th century form of anthropological British imperialism. Which, of course, in the end... was based on like a global slave trade. So the African slave trade. So which now continues today in all sorts of different modalities.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to know where to go from there, isn't it? Like the only way is down. It seems to me. The only out is out. How long do I have to continue like hanging myself in this slow?
Leading by example in apathy, perhaps.
I don't actually really care how long I have, but could someone tell me?
Maybe 30 minutes.
Okay. Well, then then I would like to come back to. And this would be a kind of a lineage of to talk about a lineage of philosophers who do indeed have something like, have had a kind of theory on the Schmittian model that men actually are evil, and then what is the best possible policy that can be erected on the basis that men are evil. And in doing this, we will find exactly what, once again, with a different vocabulary, something that Joe spoke about too, about the unfinished and incompletable nature of human beings. So, on the one hand, slavery is the very emblem of any human relationship. I've actually got a couple of jokes now. My daughter started calling. She's four. She started calling me boss whenever I ask her to do anything. She's like, "Yes, boss." It's like that's very fucking helpful. The other joke, a couple of jokes I have. One is Freud, when the Gestapo go through his house, arrest his daughter Anna, take her down to the station. She's released. It turns out that Freud's like really, really sick at the time, very old. And then Anna says, and they've also stolen, the Gestapo also stole a lot of money. He goes, "Oh, how much?" And she tells him, he goes, "Shit, they make more from a house call than I do." Like, See, that's where apathy like really stands you in good stead, I suppose. But also, the problem with apathy, and this is before I go on to the next moment, is if we have slavery, we have problems of self-dosing which accompany that slavery, the economic problem of masochism. And those problems of slavery are linked to these problems that I'm speaking about, which in a general psychoanalytic frame are called problems with... they're issues with identification. And as Freud says, part of the problem, when you identify with people, the refugees, we are all refugees and so on, is that you yourself have no fucking idea what they're going through. Not a single clue, neither do they. And he starts listing historically a galley slave in the Roman Empire. He says a German peasant in the 30 Years' War, a Jew waiting for a pogrom. Who knows what natural processes of auto-narcotization, what processes of self-stupefaction and stupidity they have done to themselves in order to even continue to survive for a second under those circumstances. And so one of the things that Freud also gets out of that is stop your fucking identifications right now. This is part of the becoming apathetic as opposed to the hyperbolic. But in that becoming apathetic, make sure that you're also, even though this is impossible, not just narcotizing yourself by other means. And so the injunction then is both do not in identify, but also in not identify, do not narcoticise. But in narcoticising, by definition, you don't know what it is that you're doing when you're doing it. Otherwise, you couldn't do it at all. Therefore, you're in a fix, right? And so what actual processes will enable you, or what techniques will enable you to get out of this circuit of identification, which continues your identification with the good and with the cruelty that you perpetrate through being and doing, thinking you're being and doing the good, or at least trying to be and do the good, or also in detaching from that and apathising yourself, making sure that it's not just another process of narcotisation, which of course you can't by definition. And so that's, I guess, the problematic that the central problematic that I'd like to propose to you this evening. But this problem, of course, has come up before. And so one of the things, I'll just go through a list. You pumped your book. I'm going to pump my book, Psychoanalysis as an Anti-Philosophy. Yeah, best cover ever. For
WebCam,
an
Quality Cambridge 2014.
Yay, all right. What's the title?
Webcam.
Webcam. Oh, that's a great title, Webcam. Like, you saw it here first? Like, if only someone was, are you filming? Are you people fucking Skyping? No. Where's your webcam? Like,
do a book launch by webcam.
It's a great idea.
Hey, I got to talk to you about how to do a book launch at readings, by the way.
No problem. We can...
Readings.
Mm. Let's do that. I think that's good. I think everyone should come. Like, the very least you can do, no one likes buying other people's books. I know this, and I really make it fucking impossible for people not to fucking come and buy it, right? Like, and if you haven't bought my book, I'm going to fucking personally, like, harass you after this. And I can see most of you are blinking embarrassedly at me. Oh, yeah, I haven't got money, I never heard about it. You can fucking... Oh, yeah, that's right. Actually, you can get everything free on the
Praxis
internet.
Praxis is the best one.
Oh, come on. Yeah, the Praxis is good. It's totally free. But since this problem has come up before, like, what are the things that people said? Like, I've just got this stupid shortlist in my book, and I'll run through it now about what actually are the fundamental bonds of human community in this kind of pre-political sense about which I'm speaking, which is what's absolutely required in order for there even to be any sort of kinship relations at all. This isn't what I'm about to tell you isn't a joke, because, of course, how does one go on under conditions of absolute extremity, as I've just said? For Freud, you cannot say anything about them, but you can at least, enumerate actions. And one of the things that happened in one of the Chinese famines of the 19th century, where there was literally nothing to eat, but families still decided they needed to go on, was they were going to have to eat their own babies. Now, no one wants to eat their own baby, so they ended up having to swap their children with the families next door in order to eat and butcher and eat the children of the neighbour.
Can we have a drink?
Who needs
drinks?
I need a drink, sorry. Infantophagia is basically infantophagia. Like, human beings are infantophagic animals. Like, yeah. Mainly I'm a shit eater, though, which is a simple coprophagic operation. And if you ever see me in my workplace, you'll see me with this, like, beaming smile eating shit, sometimes my own, mostly other people's. Like.
Tweeting this hashtag John Medley.
The hashtag John Medley, like, shit eating grin. At shit eating, hashtag shit eating grin. And so this issue, like, which of course has arisen, like, historically for every theorist of philosopher of politics. And so I'm just going to give you a crazy short list of what sort of adjectives have been given to human beings. Infantophagic is probably the best one so far in, like, 2,500 years. But, like, Aristotle: man is the most mimetic of all animals, i.e. likes to copy and likes to see copies more than any other animal. So that's one possibility. Judeo-Christianity, thank you. Man is a fallen animal, like, mainly due to women and, like, a snake. But
okay.
Machiavelli, this is a really stupid short list, but I'm just going to go through it. Machiavelli, man is a tricky animal. Why? Because Machiavelli constantly talks about, I can't recommend, the discourses are amazing, but The Prince is very short, it's unbelievably readable. And what he says is, you know, men are tricky, rapacious, unbelievably sneaky, and how do you deal with them? This is why the great prince, should he be a lion? Is it better to be loved or feared, says Machiavelli, basically. And his answer is, well, if you can have both, that's good. But basically, fear is much better, because as long as they're eating out of your ass, that's okay, they're yours. And so Machiavelli then gives a kind of great selection of techniques you should be using if you're going to be a decent, glory-seeking, like psychotic, the people who he praises in a possibly satirical way throughout The Prince, including this great incident where one of the northern Italians most feared henchman is absolutely out of control. But you can actually persecute people too much, as Machiavelli points out, at which point you'd better make sure that you have your own most famous henchman cut up into four pieces and his body parts found in the city squares all around northern Italy, because then people think, he's thinking about us. He really cares. He's just got rid of his most feared henchman for us. And then, of course, as Machiavelli says, then you just up the persecution, because, of course, you've given them this little bit of flesh, back. But so for Machiavelli, man is a tricky animal, and that's why it's better to be feared than loved. But, you know, a bit of love never harmed any tyrant. For Locke, man is a social animal, which is obviously one of the most stupid things ever said. For Voltaire, man is a sensible animal. It's not true. For Rousseau, who actually is one of the targets of Carl Schmitt, because Rousseau basically thinks that human beings are basically good but corrupted by society. For Rousseau, man is a contracting animal. You're constantly contracting yourself in making contracts with other people. Now, I think that's kind of true, but that, you know, you want more of the Freudian attitude towards this contract than is often given. For Kant, and this is obviously bullshit, but I like it, a man is a maturing animal, you know. God bless, like a good matured wine, God bless him, yeah. Hegel, man is a, well, you know, yeah, for Hegel, man is a prestigious animal. You are fighting for prestige, and then this comes back to some of the things that Joe says. There is always a struggle to be better than the next person. That's not such a bad thing, is it? Bentham, man is a useful animal, and you know, Bentham, after he died, he insisted on having his body stuffed so he could still be useful after death. The problem was that none of the Englishmen who stuffed him realised had good head curing processes, because despite their anthropological interest in head shrinkers from around the world, they had no idea of what techniques are actually used for keeping a dead man's head the same size after his death. And so when they tried to treat Bentham's body, they just stuffed it like a fucking kangaroo. So it's still around. I'll come back to this in a minute. But the head shrank massively because they'd forgotten the old techniques, which, you know, if they were good imperialists, the good imperialist anthropologist should have actually fucking done a bit more work. So his head shrank. So they had to replace his head with a fake with glass eyes, which was then reattached to the stuffed body.
And it looks like paper mache.
Yes, and you can find it. Where can
at
you find
UCL
it?
UCL in London and Bloomsbury.
You can find it UCL London and Bloomsbury. And he's kept in a cabinet, which they open at meetings, and he's always listed as attending the meeting still, but being a non-participating member. So you can be useful even when you're dead, but this is where we might come back to Australia as the bastard. Yeah.
This is why I tend to tell people, I work for UCL. Coldplay went to UCL.
Mm. And so did, well, and Bentham is still at UCL. He never never really left, did he? How great would that be, stuffed in a cabinet? What he really wanted is for him, after his death, to be used in pedagogical scenes for future generations, where he would be, his body would be wheeled on in historical confrontations with Aristotle and Plato and stuff. And at every, he would say, the Jeremy Bentham stuffed Bentham would say, no, it is the greatest good for the greatest number, the philosophic calculus. And then everyone, all the kids would go, yes, that has really trumped Aristotle. Bentham. Bentham has taught us something. So man is a useful animal. The Romantics, man is a baby animal, which is obviously an anti-Kantian thing, and I'm quite keen on this. We're all still kind of fucking baby animals. Thomas de Quincey, man is an addictive animal. Marx, man is a working animal. Nietzsche, and this is where we're getting slightly creepy, man is a herd animal, and I would like to point out to you, when Nietzsche says man is a herd animal, he's thinking of Aristotle. What is the most mimetic of all animals? An animal like humans, who like copying others and seeing the copies of others staged for their own delectation. What Nietzsche immediately recognises in this is that's what a herd does. A herd is always follow the leader, and so human beings, and this is precisely what he means by the Übermensch, which of course had the fateful history that it did under the Nazis, the sign of the Nazism, with which I suppose that I spoke of briefly before, is that all of us are constantly copying the ass of what we see of the animal in front of us doing, and still desperately trying to follow that even as it moves from side to side. And so every change that we think we're making in ourselves, no, we're just following the leader. But part of the problem, as Nietzsche also points out in man is a herd animal, is that we're also following ourselves. We're following traces that we ourselves have laid down in our own immediate development, such that we're constantly following the outside, the ass of the sheep in front of us, but we're also following the ass of the sheep that we always already were in our own history. And so that we're already, as Nietzsche is trying to point out with man as a herd animal, that we ourselves are already a multiple, we're not singular, we're a herd. Every self for Nietzsche is a herd, both following the outside bum and our inside asses simultaneously too. Now when Freud, and I'll come back to this and then I'll say a few words before finishing, a few more words about camp life before finishing. I'm going to roll another cigarette because of that. Like,
Just before you move on, what do you think about the kind of, David Graeber, anarchist types who talk a lot about gift exchange, like man's sharing?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, and man isn't a sharing animal. Man is, and this is where I take very, very seriously the problem that all of these responses are interesting and powerful responses, and Graeber is actually quite a powerful contemporary response insofar as showing how money works and financial systems work and the origins of money, essentially, in the way how could that even have developed, and so both the inventiveness of humanity but also the exploitation in the very generosity that leads imaginarily to all of these crazy but at the same time, like Alter in the way that Joe was speaking about too, rationalist responses, and trying to get back in a kind of almost, it seems to me, Rousseauistic way to a kind of fundamental good that's in humans that has been expropriated through their own generosity, in and through that generosity, but show that has to be the basis that we can always touch on again. That would seem to me my feeling about Graeber. And I don't mind it, except for the fact that in my list that I'm trying to give is that all of these adjectives are kind of attempts to speak about this like fundamental volatility of humans, or try and give it a spin in order to, but all of them are kind of going to fail because, or not fail, but they do get something right. But in targeting that, there's all of these other things too that they don't quite want to take care of. And that's what I guess I'm saying man is a cruel animal, is to say, yes, a cruel animal can share a lot, but only because in order to be that generous, they've done a lot of work of cruelty on themselves. So I don't want to say cruel is better, it's just a totally psychoanalytic thing, but from the perspective of that cruelty, how does generosity look? Generosity looks like exactly something the cruel animal would perform, and also explain how that all of the divagations and exploitations that then Grave attracts, you know, quite plausibly, not extremely persuasively and historically, you can still say, actually, that's generosity is always an act of cruelty in Freud, for instance.
Kind of falling back on like a Scottish Enlightenment kind of
thing. Yeah, I think that's right.
Some agonistic game of like self-regulated cruel passions or whatever.
Except for Freud, and this is what makes him a bit different, is that the Scottish Enlightenment themselves are worth talking about in a number of ways, because some of the greatest philosophers of the 18th century, actually, you know, Adam Smith, Francis Hutcheson, there's a number of these guys who are really, really absolutely great and very, very important thinkers whose thoughts still has a great deal of impact upon contemporary, contemporary thinking and action in ways that go beyond, you know, anyone necessarily knowing their name. However, the thing about cruelty and Freud, and this is maybe something I'll probably finish with this, I've already alluded to it, but is that the rational self-interest, according to Freud, is always a cruelty. That cruelty actually goes beyond any self-interest. It would fucking destroy itself, and we are destroying ourselves, and we're not only happily destroying ourselves, we couldn't be more excited at the impending fucking disaster that we're contributing to. That goes beyond any possible self-interest. And so it's not the auto-regulation that Freud points to in his cruelty. When he points to cruelty, he points to something that goes beyond itself continuously into another abyss and another abyss, and is happy to jump. And in fact, as I said with the, say, camp life, like, is now happy to idealize camps such that camps now reappear everywhere with like unbelievable frequency and enjoyability. Man is not a camp animal, it's not a camping animal, which could be another thing, but actually it's the unregulatable nature of this volatile cruelty that I think Freud points to that goes way beyond that sort of enlightenment size. And this is where we come to Freud, because when Freud speaks explicitly in 1920 and 1921, he writes two books in particular, both of them very short and very nasty books. But as I said, Freud, I love reading Freud because he has such a happy, not apathetic, he's very, he's passionately detached from the things that he's speaking about. And one of the things he speaks about is beyond the pleasure principle, which is where he introduces the concept, and this is the concept of absolutely unregulatable human cruelty, which is that of the death drive. And which has a number of different interpretations, and the other one's around, the other book is around a mass identification. And both of those books are very, very weird. They seem antithetical if you read them together. They're written almost about the same time. And in Beyond the Pleasure Principle, it simply opens with a number of very weird things, including dreams of shell-shocked soldiers. Now, Freud, as you might know, in his masterpiece, which is The Interpretation of Dreams from 1899-1900, he says, the motive of every dream is a wish. Someone was telling me her dream before, and its fulfillment is a wish. So even though they're hideous, sometimes hideous, like, actually, that's what you want. Like, you know, you're a cruel animal. The only way you can tell yourself what you want by, you know, killing refugee babies, is this right? Like, the only way you can tell yourself that is something horrible that comes up in the night which you had no control over, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, Freud wants to say, even for really hideous dreams up till at least 1920, they're still motivated by wishes. But what he finds with something like shell-shocked soldiers, is that dreams repeat which clearly have no benefit whatsoever for the organism, and the problematic of repetition that by and of an organism of its a particular act, which has no benefits whatsoever for that organism, is an index of something that he wants to nominate death drive. Death drive doesn't mean I just want death. That comes under the pleasure principle. Like, you know, people always want death. I'm half in love with easeful death, as John Keats, the romantic poet, almost said. No, suicide's been a big, you know, so we could talk about suicide. I don't want to talk about suicide, but that's but with these repetitions are so out of control. They're so not geared to the health of the organism, and at the same time, they're completely compulsive. Repetition compulsion becomes an index of something that's extra inscribed within the organism, but nonetheless the organism can't help performing to its own detriment. And Freud actually says, what is the death drive? He says it's the drive to return to an earlier state of things when we were just matter. Now, that is not an index of happiness. That can't be reconciled by the organism. We can have, like, apocalyptic dreams, which are always, like, fabulous and, like, exciting. But that's not quite what he's saying here. So beyond the pleasure principle, says, yes, man is a slave animal in this really profound sense of repetition compulsion back to death. But also, and this is the biggest problem, is that sex and death for Freud are invented simultaneously. When he starts to speak about monocellular organisms and pathogenesis in that book, an organism that splits or clones itself literally never dies. Individual expressions are like this mass of it might die, but actually through pathogenesis, just splitting, cloning indefinitely, you'll never really die. But that's not sexual, it's just self-splitting. The problem is that sex and death are invented simultaneously for Freud. When you have sexual organisms that propagate through dimorphic sexuality, sometimes through even weirder forms of sexuality, which I'm happy to talk about if anyone has questions about rhizocephalans at the end of this talk, is that sex and death are invented together. And that problem means human beings are at once slave animals and they're sex animals, and sex animal means you're always going to have to deal with women, and that's a big problem, as we've already seen for every... And we deal with women, as Freud says, Hegel himself said this, women must be always the eternal irony of community. There's something excessive about sex, which goes in one direction, but there's also something excessive about death, which takes us in another direction. And this is why there's absolutely no reconciliation possible. There's always this excessive. But then in his book on mass identification, Freud turns to something else, like weird, how are armies possible? How do you organise people into camps and so forth? And he says, no, it can't be that man is a herd animal. It must be that man is a horde animal. And what's a horde animal? A horde animal is something very, very different. A horde animal is a primal horde, and we are, each of us, this primal horde, completely out of control, completely going beyond the limits of our own subjectivity, completely going beyond the limits of anything that we know, and doing always beyond what we do. That is where I'm going to finish. I'm interested if you have questions. I'm going to say that a horde animal has met its, like, end in the camp animal, and of which, you know, camping it up, like, with the horde animal is where we are today. So everyone's having a good time. Keep having a good time. Thank you very much. Like... I've done use the blackboard. Before you do that, can I do something I wanted to do? Because I have to use the blackboard.
Yeah. Please
but
do.
In my dreams, I had cast straight at the blackboard. It was much smaller than I thought when I turned up. But this is what I wanted to do to it, because I had to use it. I'm not sure if this is going to work, which is like...
The best thing about that, Justin, was every time you went to ash your smoke, you sort of acted out this theatre as if you were about to. But then instead...
You didn't.
Well, this is a Paul Celan Holocaust thing. It's like ashes, you know, Shulamit dein ashenes haar, you know, Margaret dein goldenes haar, etc.
Does anyone have any questions for Justin or Joe, seeing as they're both up there? Go nuts. Now's the time. Anybody?
Will there be a garage camp?
Oh, yeah.
No, never.
It's a good question. Well, we should. What are you people of fucking hopeless organisers? Like, get these people into fucking rows. Divide them up. I want to, like, sonder garage. Like.
Can you talk about contract a bit more, maybe? Mm. I mean, I think, like, because you touched on Rousseau before, one of the interesting things I think about the whole David Graeber gift exchange thing, which I guess I'm interested in, which is why I asked you.
Oh, absolutely.
Can is I that, please pick on you after Justin?
Well, yeah, sure. Why don't you answer for me? That would be better.
Like, it's just this sense that, like, you know, you've got all this life, whether it be, you know, gratuitous gift-giving or horrible cruelty or whatever, and that human societies at some level are like a set of contractual obligations that tries to lock that into some kind of institutional form, you know.
Absolutely.
Either like consensually, oh, I agree to some arrangement with you, or this Scottish Enlightenment thing, you know, we just self-regulate each other. And that part of the reason why things like the refugee thing happens is because life keeps overstepping the boundaries of these contracts, which can't contain it. And that attracts an hysterical overreach by government, by, you know, which is either legal, so, you know, excising people from the migration zone or sending them on PNG or whatever, or, you know, quasi-illegal or illegal, so, you know, corporate fraud or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, it seems to me that, like, to just say, oh, human beings are all just cruel, that, like, actually a lot of the cruelty comes from keeping good impulses inside these contractual boundaries.
Yeah.
And that maybe, like, you know, I'm not as miserable as you about human conduct.
Yeah. No, 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 that's totally right, and I totally hear that. And I guess what I would say is that when Freud says cruelty, and this is what I wanted to be very specific about, he's not just talking about, I just want to be mean to another person. He's talking about something that goes in an excess of itself that nonetheless cannot go in excess of itself without requiring another at the same time. And that is already a generosity, but generosity, it seems to me, in contractual obligations can be explained by a kind of vitality of human cruelty in a way that cruelty cannot be explained simply by the generosity, right? And I think there's a, I would say there's an asymmetry. That's too quick an answer, firstly, to your question. The other thing is, yes, you can see how rationalistic processes that work for a particular situation. I think of a Peter Sloterdijk quote, which is, he got in a lot of trouble for this essay in Germany in the late 90s for reasons that you'll understand. It's called Rules for the Human Zoo. And he basically says, you know, what is human life? But it's a set of breeding programs, right? Just, and human beings, unlike any other animal, are the only animal that likes to put them, put itself in cages. What are those cages? Sometimes those cages are real cages, like the slave cages, or sometimes those cages are contractual cages. But it's the only animal on earth that ever put itself in a cage and clearly continues to like to do that. Then you've got an explanatory gap around the problem of generosity and contracts. That's one. And then he says, as a consequence, what do we have? We have human beings who are always confronted by problems that are too hard for them because they need new cages, because that's the only way, really, that they can think about fixing the problem with the old cages. And those cages, like, mandate generosity. Fine, sometimes. But that doesn't mean that, like, human beings are generous in any way. No, it means that we've got, like, some better breeding programs to engage in. And a breeding program is always about mating people with other people who don't want to be mated with. And we're back to cruelty. I'm going to talk about, I want to just give one very specific instance, which it seems to me is absolutely determining for contemporary global modernity, which is quite weird. And it's like, what does it mean that in the Jewish faith, like, this may look like a gap, but I'm going to come back to it, is why is succession entirely matrilineal? Has this got anything to do with feminism in Judaism? No, it has zero to do with feminism. What it has to do with is, what are the Jews? The Jews are a slave people. The entire every holy writing of the Jews is about God has chosen us, and what has God chosen us for? Has chosen us for slavery. What does it mean to be a slave? There's two things. One, if you're a male slave, you will be worked to death and you will not propagate. If you're a female slave, you will be worked to death and you will be worked to death through reproduction, but you will not reproduce with your own people. You will reproduce with the master. All right? So the matrilineal lineage, very crucial in Judaism, which makes some people Jews irrelevantly and some people not in our globalised modernity. What was the justification of that? This is a slave people who wants to retain an identity, because if you are raped, your child will still be considered Jewish. And why do I, you can see why I'm saying this in this context is that the very conditions under which people try to ensure a transmission to the future, it's better to be a slave rather than nothing, and a slave people who are chosen in the Jewish idealization. That's the only justification I can see that is a good example of matrilinear transmission in Judaism. It's because of basically rape and exploitation, but people still try and find a way through. That is part of the greatness, I guess, of the Jewish imagination. But to come back to this generosity, yeah. it's not about contract. Like,
but then I guess there's the whole thing where, you know, it's not strictly a slave relationship; it's a covenant, but nonetheless, they have to choose to obey the covenant anyway. So it's a kind of perverse.
But that's exactly, and that's exactly that's exactly. And what does it mean? Why is matrilineal? Why in a religion that's about God? You know, God the Father and this crazy God, if you've read the Old Testament recently, which is even Christian to call it the Old Testament. So the Jewish holy books. Yes, God is utterly masculine society. Why is matrilinearity? So because basically your condition is that of the slave, and so the covenant with the people is to say you will go forward, but you will go forward as slaves. And going the chosenness, the being chosen of the Jewish people, is entirely the covenant that God makes. Made several covenants, and the Jewish people are not a good people even for their own God in the Old Testament or the Jewish books, like when Moses has to get the Ten Commandments twice because he comes down the first time they've made the golden calf. And sorry, I didn't mean to get into like a biblical reading, but it is a Sunday school, as I was saying to someone before. Yes, you're right. But on the basis of how do a slave people go forward? Well, they implement some very weird transmission lines, I guess.
And then where does consent? Can people ever have consensual agreements then under your model?
Absolutely. We consent all the time, but that consent takes place on basically, and that's why I do think something about Judaism that is so crucial to remember in terms of this the idea of slavery is that every contract comes from the place that you are a slave people. Like, how do you go forward? You might have a contract with God. You don't have a contract with anything in the world. And what God will do will punish you and send you back into slavery again and again. But your contract means you have to go on. That's not a good contract. It's not a happy contract. It's not suffering gives you knowledge. It's just, how do you find a way to keep going? And that's, yeah. So people can contract and feel happy about it, but it's kind of up here. It's not.
I have a question, sort of like a mashup of two things that you've both said, So you were talking about the identity of people in Trinidad, and you were talking about how Indigenous people, like, placeless in Australia. So I was wondering if you could, like, comment on some combination of that, because when you were talking, I was wondering how do Indigenous people find an identity in a place that is overrun by a culture that's not their own, the history that they can't reconcile with.
Can I take this first question? Absolutely. Like your answer will be better.
That was so mean to me. Wait, how can you be so mean? Go on, Joe. Yeah.
My first answer to that question would be both Australia and Trinidad are pluralistic societies, but the difference between the two societies is, as Justin said at the start of his lecture, the principle of terra nullius. So we're at once, Indigenous people are both of the nation, but also separated, pushed out, unable to participate in both, more, I would argue, the state and the nation.
Yeah.
whereas Trinidad, what was your question again?
So it was sort of about relating the Indigenous situation that Justin described to what you were saying about Trinidad.
Cool. Indigenous people in Trinidad were obliterated in like the 1500s, 1600s in the name of progress. Those are the Caribs, the Arawaks, Indigenous people to that island. So again,
and it begins with Spain, doesn't it? Is it a Spanish island?
Yes. Yeah. So it had its own kind of experience of terra nullius. But then after those Indigenous people were obliterated, the Spanish came in and said, "All right, this is a country. We're going to call it the Holy Trinity, Trinidad." And these are going to be its people. So 400 years of Afro-Trinidadian slavery, 200 years of indentureship, under with Indo-Trinidadians, which still exist to this day, is this pluralistic, well, hang on a second, I have a right to exist as an Indo-Trinidadian, I have a right to exist as Afro-Trinidadian, whereas, of course, both sides of the argument eat into the legitimacy of the nation and the state itself. Because both link back to their imaginations of, well, hang on a second, if we're Indo-Trinidadians, we want to bring Indian culture to Trinidad, but we're Indo-Trinidadians. We're not like India, but we want to infuse that into our idea of what being an Indo-Trinidadian is. Whereas Afro-Trinidadians, it's like, well, we know we're not Mother Africa. We know we don't have the same experience of black power, say, as in the United States, but how do we exist as a cultureless, invisible people presently? Sorry. So that's the first point. But also, where Afro-Trinidadians differ from Indigenous Australians are, whether you want to call it being forced, being fucking invited, being, you know, made complicit with, whatever, they are being asked to join this homogenous culture that is the nation of Australia and either do this, and I would say it's in explicit terms, or do this or perish as a culture. Whereas with Trinidad, having 40% of the population Indo and 40% of the population Afro, both at least get to sort of say, well, we are a nation as of 1968. Let's at least have some thought of what kind of nation we want to be, rather than being swallowed under this homogenous hole of what the culture should be. Sorry. I want to take up the point with this young man over here about human beings are sharing animals. I think your answer also... No, what was it? Human beings are social animals. I think that just shat all over Durkheim and Sahlins and all of those at once. Half of the Manchester School of Anthropology as well. Brilliant.
Yeah. And the heartland of the Industrial Revolution too, Manchester, where you could start to like produce with like new wage slaves and the proletariat, all the things that you'd have to use cotton picking slaves for.
Exactly. There's no coincidence that the Manchester School of Anthropology dominates within the anthropological imagination today, and it came up at the exact same time as industrialization. How do we expand our colonies? Interesting. One of ye olde dead. Exoticist, orientalist, othering anthropologist Marshall Sahlins, who came up with this, with the idea of, well, social organisation as a political organisation was based on sharing, but let's look at sharing properly. Sharing is not sharing based in generosity or altruism, it's based on the cohesiveness of social organisation, that is, negotiation of obligation and reciprocity. So how... Again, this kind of leads itself to distribution of goods, distribution of resources, and blah, blah, blah. But the social organisation of sharing is actually one based on, I think, is its long-term transactionalism. Also contains a very distinct Adam Smithian logic of individual maximising profit, economic individual rationality. So even in those... such societies which we exoticise as other and romanticise as native or whatever, there is a very distinct logic of transactionalism based on rational self-interested individual and maximising profit, which then comes back to rather than working cruelty into a system, rather creating a political economy which allows cruelty to kind of be neatly pushed out over here. It's all negotiation. It's all reciprocity.
Yep.
It's all adhering to obligation. So cruelty can kind of sit over there rather than legitimizing itself through force.
Justin, this is more of a general question. It's not super relevant. But you mentioned that like Taoist apathy idea of do without doing, teach without talking, yada yada. But you're clearly very passionate about academia and your studies. So how do you reconcile that interest with this apathy solution?
Well, you know, I always hated Taoism and, like, Buddhism and, like, you know, ancient forms of philosophy that basically, you know, like, generate one or another technique, like, and also rationale for those techniques, which are all about a form of detachment. But, you know... I'm a very enthusiastic person, which is just an index of my cruelty, I guess, like, and also self-cruelty and, like, you know, viciousness. And so I've had to come to the point where I actually have to recognise that these things that seem stupid to me and stupefying are actually not... quite the contrary. They're trying to do something.
Is it not the fact that you're a sucker for punishment?
I'm a sucker for both of those things. I'm a sucker for punishment, but to come to understand that there's something in Taoism that... And I'll come back to something else with regards to what Joe was saying too in my answer to this question, is that, you know, is that, no, they're perhaps genuine ways of trying to have a human community through, like, rationalizing incredible techniques that are not about that are not about maintaining the status quo or being revolutionary or even rebellious, but trying to find in oneself and in others a different relationship to all of these modalities of being that get you out of precisely the word which I like, this hyperbole of response, and that's a very fucking hard thing to do, and it can look very fucking stupid, particularly to someone like me, who's like, right? But also, to come back to something that Joe was saying, is like, you know, the cruelty is now, like, direct, you know, without something like that, or some sort of, countervalent movement out of this, you end up in the situation that Joe was describing with Trinidadian ex-slaves, where you're fucked one way or you're fucked the other way. It's like, no, I'm going on. I'm going to go on in the way that I'm going to go. Why are you now fucking addressing me as if the way I've chosen to go on is so, you know, is somehow compromised, and I should be not only thoughtful of the compromise that you claim that I'm now engaging in, but that I have to be fucking part of this history, and I have to be not part of this history, and you're making me do those things at once. And so that's why, you know, to come back to the Taoist thing, I can see all of those Taoist techniques, which are, in particularly in Taoism, a withdrawal to the top of a mountain, a lot of meditation, maybe a lot of fishing. There's some suicides in Taoism, and there's a lot of, like, weird qi exercises too. But all of these things are, like, whatever my contempt for the what I see as those doctrines, I have to say that my contempt for those doctrines is precisely an index of my captured by the very thing that I've been claiming to you that I'm against. But actually, no.
Can I springboard off that?
Yes.
Obviously, the next lecture we do together is just going to be a dialogue.
Or a diatribe,
yes,
Joe.
Yes.
Like,
yeah. On your point of, I suppose, mediating and containing cruelty, and I don't think this really links to your question, but it does spring off the points that you just said. So, for example, when you look at the collapse of the Belgian Congo, so, and yeah, it gets more bleak. Belgian Congo, now we're there. Heart of darkness.
The heart of darkness.
And Justin already knows where this is going to go. So at the end of the decolonization of Belgian Congo, when Mobutu came into power, the first thing he did was change the name of the country and of every city in the country to Zaire. So, I think Leopoldville became Kinshasa, etc., etc. So all the names that were given by the Belgian expansion of the empire was completely negated, completely erased, and given African names in the name of Pan-Africanism. And this is where we start to see, again, this pendulum just swinging one way and just biting you in the ass, in the same way that it did in the Cambodian genocide, was to expel all and purge all foreign influences that tried to implicate, tried to create progress and create modernism. We are going to have our own, and this is where it becomes really bleak, really depressing, and really just, we are going to, not only are we going to have our own experience of modernity, we're going to fucking create our own experience of modernity, and in the name of Pan-Africanism, Khmer revivalism, whatever. This is where, unfortunately, nationalisms do come back in. So, and this is where it's this kind of sad for Afro-Trinidadians, it's split between the two, because some Afro-Trinidadians prescribe to this sense of Pan-Africanism. In order to be who I am in 2013, I want to go back to those roots that I lost, i.e. my African identity. Whereas other Afro-Trinidadians kind of go, we've kind of lost that. Even if we have it now, or we're trying to attain that now, it's going to be some kind of perverse, distorted, reimagined form of that. So can't we just kind of move forward? You're not African enough. And it's just like, this is the crisis that is that exists within pluralistic societies, where even for one sense of self, who legitimately exists more than another?
Yeah, well, that's cruelty, isn't it? It's like, you always... I exist more legitimately than you exist, like, frankly, is that right?
Exactly.
Like, yeah. In fact, I'm the most legitimate person in this room. Who are you, bozos?
On that note, step in. Yeah.
Thank you again to Justin, cruel Justin, and Joe. The artwork. Everyone's prepared to hang around. Lachlan said he'll get the guitar out soon. There's a bit more drink to finish.
I think Lachlan must get his guitar out because we've just all made everyone just go, we're going to...
We need to sing along.
I think we need to sing along. There's also more...
Maybe I'll catch your greatest
thanks for our sponsor.
Really?
Yeah, well, if you're keen.
Well, I'll have another shot. I think I need one.
I think it's a great idea.
Is that all right?
Yeah,
like, that'd be great. Like,
before we have more shots, do we have... we do, yes. Yay.
No, you guys give me too much booze already. Booze.
We'll buy you cheap wine.
There's better be cheap wine at least.
Yours is really expensive.
What did you get?
Oh, maker's table.
You did get it.
Joe.
What one's yours?
Mine's a Rosemount. We spent heaps of money.
Yeah.
If anyone wants to contribute to the garage fund, now's the time. This is the garage.
Can someone have a shot because I'm stirring it?
I'll hold it. Sorry.
Half that counts.
Who's there for me?
You
three.
Sorry.
1, 2, 3,
thank
go.
To slavery, infant, failure, suicide, and the Bible.
Thanks very much, Joe and Justin. Probably going to, close the doors, bring it in, keep the warmth in. Finish the keg, we'll just kind of, close it off so that the wind is not so cold.
Thank you. That was good. Thank you. It's great for me.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
It's so great.
Joe, fantastic. We should clean fossils. Thank you, guys. I really don't think so.